Well, welcome everyone. I feel so privileged and honored to have this massive room and all of you attend. So thank you very much. I suspect a lot of people are in the line that I cut in front of about 30 minutes ago because I was running late, which was rather long. So I am happy to have you here. My name is Brad Hunstable. I'm one of the founders of a company called Ustream. If you want to follow me on Twitter, there's an E at the end of my Twitter handle, Hunstable, with an E at the end. It's cut off, unfortunately. But welcome. I'm here to talk a little bit. The title of the panel, or I guess it's not a panel, I'm not debating myself, but the title of my presentation is The World Turns to Ustream in Times of Crisis. And I want to talk a little bit about our company, Ustream. We are a live broadcasting platform that allows anyone to broadcast from everything from an HD camera all the way down to your cell phone. And again, we really focus on the live broadcasts. And a little bit of facts to brag on ourselves some. We broadcast or ingest more video per second than any video site in the world. Not only are we the largest live streaming site, but we ingest more video than anyone, including YouTube. We actually got a Guinness Book of World Record for that. We do about 50 million uniques worldwide, somewhere around 200,000 broadcasts on a given month. And every minute, there's about 100 hours of video uploaded to Ustream that pass through our servers. So pretty remarkable considering the fact that we're a fraction of the size of YouTube and only about 170 people worldwide. We have offices in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Tokyo. We also have an office in Budapest, and we just opened an office in Seoul, Korea. And my background, for those of you who don't know, I'm from Texas. So welcome to the greatest country in the world. I'm very honored to give a speech here. And, you know, for those of you who haven't heard of Ustream, but you may have heard of some of our content, whether that be celebrity web chats. A lot of celebrities go on Ustream to interact with their fans. Or you may have seen a high school football game that was live on Ustream for your son or daughter. Or perhaps you watched a UFC pay-per-view live on Ustream. Or maybe you watched a Bon Jovi concert over the last couple of years live through our website. Or perhaps you watched President Obama's victory speech in his inauguration in 2008 live on Ustream. We were the official streaming provider for him. Or maybe you have heard of the Puppy Cam, which got a Webby Award that I was very proud of in 2009, was at the time the largest live broadcast ever. And that was actually passed by the current reigning champion, the Eagle Cam, where 225 million people last year tuned in to watch it. A lot of school-age kids and a lot of educational outlets. And of course, our good friend Charlie Sheen did term some words last year, winning in Tiger Blood live on Ustream. But I'm not here to talk about that. In fact, I'm actually here to talk about a much more serious subject, because over the last four and a half years since we started the company, in many cases, whether that be a natural disaster, whether it be a crisis of some sort or a protest, the world has turned to Ustream in these times. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But before that, I do that, let me tell you a story about myself. I grew up here in Texas. And growing up here, which was fantastic, I decided I want to have a little bit of adventure in my life. And I went to what's called West Point, the United States Military Academy at West Point. And at West Point, or after West Point, you have to serve 5 years in the Army. And my experience in the Army, I saw a situation where people who were serving overseas had very limited time to call home to their families. And so the inspiration behind the company was actually to solve a problem where people who had limited time could call home through video to their loved ones, and their loved ones who might be in Florida, your wife was in Florida, but your mother was in Texas, your sister was in California, all of them wanted to speak with you. And because you were in the military, whether you were at war or you were stationed somewhere, you may only have 15 minutes to call home. You may only have 15 minutes to call home. And we felt like, wouldn't it be nice if you could have a way in a one-to-many fashion for people to be able to communicate with you? And of course, we've evolved much greater than that. But the fundamental thesis of Ustream is still the same: to power one to many broadcasts, whether that be 10 people or a million people. And our dream, as it says on the screen, this is our calling in life. We want to bring the world together by immersing viewers in live broadcast that create riveting experiences, interactive communities, and lasting connections. We talk about this every week at Ustream, and that's really the power and why in a crisis we have the ability to provide some very meaningful information. And how did we get here? How were we able to do that? I want to tell you a little bit about the history. And of course, we live in a world today where an HD webcam might cost $49. Your MacBook probably has a webcam built into it. Above the penny is an iPhone camera. And the cost of those have come down so much that Apple's able to put not one, but two in there. And the proliferation of this is a very powerful enabling function for Ustream. And the internet distribution, this is the map of the modern internet, has allowed us to be incredibly enabled. I can remember back in 2008 when we weren't as evolved, at least in the United States, some of the troubles of doing a live broadcast. But over the last 4 or 5 years, things like LTE are starting to permeate across America. In Korea, they have LTE that does 100 up and 100 down, which is pretty remarkable. And so, and actually in many of the third world countries like Africa, you're seeing the countries and the communities bypass broadband and go straight to high-speed LTE mobile internet. And so the enablement of this has created a unique opportunity for us to start serving this into multiple platforms. So you're able to broadcast from any phone, or from an Android phone, I say any phone, Android and iPhones, and view it on any platform, whether that be a mobile phone, an iPad, or even your television. And those platforms are allowing, for the first time, audiences to be aggregated at a speed and a scale that we've never seen. The enablement of Facebook and the real-time nature of Twitter has been a tremendous multiplier for our business. And this is a snapshot. This is a globe we actually have in the front of our office. And it's an animation that spins. Each one of those vertical shining lines represents a city and the number of viewers in that city. And this is the backside of the world when we did the snapshot. It's at nighttime, so you can see most of the world is asleep. But there's one I want to call out that's one really big. That's actually from Cairo, Egypt. And that was on a day when 400 people died in a riot because of a soccer game. And there were live broadcasts from citizen journalists on the ground, somewhere around 30 or 40, who were broadcasting the coverage of riot police with tear gas and batons pushing back the crowd. And the crowd was very unhappy with how it all went down. And that was just one snapshot. But it's allowed us to bring audiences in real time to these live broadcasts and really create, as I said, from our dream, these very immersive experiences. And that's leads me to the power of Ustream as it relates to, at least from a news angle. I'm going to show you some pretty powerful demonstrations of how both citizen journalism, journalists, and mainstream media are utilizing the technology to bring information, to bring lasting connections, and to bring these interactive communities. And one of the ones that we're really proud of was in 2010. You may remember this, but about 7 million people tuned in to watch the Chilean miners on Ustream be recovered from the underground. That happened obviously over a course of several weeks, but that information and that news we were able to bring to the world. In February 2010 in Chile, you may recall as well, they had another tragedy, which was an earthquake, one of the worst in the Chilean history. And we had many citizen journalists on the ground that were literally filming the coverage of the Chilean earthquake. And at that time, CNN, at least for the first day or so, they weren't able to get satellite trucks on the ground. I don't know if it's because they didn't have relationships with the Chilean media outlets or just because the destruction was so bad. But for that first day, CNN was relying on feeds from Ustream to provide that information to the world. Really interesting, really very powerful use of the technology. And then, of course, on March 11th. No, unfortunately not. There's some rules against that with South by Southwest, unfortunately. So, not my fault. I would love to. Well, going back to what I was saying, on March 11th of last year, and this was one that hit very near to our hearts, was the Japanese disaster. And Ustream, and you people in the U.S. don't realize this, in Asia, specifically in Japan, we are actually kind of a big deal. And I say that somewhat jokingly, but the reality is we have an office there. We have 25 people on the ground in Tokyo, and we have a presence. And I can remember I did a board meeting it was the 10th U.S. time in March with our Japanese partners, and we use video conference because we can't always fly back and forth. And I just finished, it was at night, like around 10 p.m., I just finished the board meeting with our Japanese team. And went back to my place and turned on my computer as soon as I got in there, and the earthquake had just happened. And what transpired was rather powerful. In the northern, I think they call them precincts, the northern part of Japan, the population literally could not get terrestrial television. And if they didn't have a satellite, box already, they had very limited way of getting information. And so the decision was made throughout Japan by the major broadcast networks like NHK and TBS. That's the equivalent of, CNN or ABC. They put their linear feeds live on Ustream, which had 24/7 coverage of what was happening. And the reason they did that was mostly out of a desire to get information to the people who were in those precincts who had literally no other way to find out what was going on, at least from a video standpoint, a live video standpoint, but using their mobile phone and watching it on Ustream. This is a blog post, and I actually have a picture of this story right here. I pulled this from a blog post, but I have a picture of people outside an Apple store in one of those northern areas, and the Apple employees had put the Ustream feeds, TBS, NHK, there was like four or five of them. They'd pushed plasma TVs to the front of the glass of the Apple store. And at 11 o'clock at night, Apple was closed. There's 100 people from that town huddled around outside the store getting information about what was happening. And if you recall, it was actually very scary because they had the tsunami and then the nuclear issue. There was a lot of confusion and a lot of misinformation. Over the course of this event, 53 million people worldwide tuned in to watch this unfold. We had citizen journalists on the ground who were literally broadcasting almost right after it had happened, the level of the destruction. The Japanese government were using some of those feeds to get more information. It was quite remarkable what happened. We saw it as well last year with Hurricane Irene. If you recall, Hurricane Irene hit most of the East Coast. And we had about 7 million people tune in to watch this. But we had 130 hurricane cams pop up on the Ustream platform that showed the different areas. You can literally watch the hurricane as it moved up the coast and see it happening live. And what was interesting, while the content of the hurricanes wasn't perhaps the most interesting, the other part of our dream is to create these interactive communities. And so people came and they were talking about hurricanes. They were asking questions. They were trying to get information. It was a really powerful experience for those who watched. One thing I forgot to mention, going back to the Japanese disaster. If you remember what happened on 3/11, they had the earthquake in Japan. Then they had the tsunami that hit Japan, which caused all the nuclear issue. And if you recall, there was fear that there was a tsunami headed towards the United States. And no one knew what was going to happen, if you remember this. And so the tsunami was coming towards the United States. BJ Penn, I happen to be a fan of mixed martial arts, but BJ Penn is an ultimate fighter, pulled out his iPhone, unbeknownst to us, which had his Ustream app, and he lived in Hilo, Hawaii, and pulled out his iPhone and was streaming from his phone, waiting for the tsunami to come in. Now, the tsunami ended up being only about 6 inches, but no one knew that at the time. And he's talking to CNN on the phone, and CNN's pulling his feed from his balcony of his room in Hilo, completely unknown to us. He's doing this because of the power and the ubiquity of the technology. In 2011, it actually started early 2011 and somewhat in 2010, we started seeing this groundswell of people broadcasting with our mobile applications because, again, the networks are getting better, the cameras are getting better, our own technologies are getting better. And it started actually with the Iranian the protests that got shut down by President Ahmadinejad. And the Ayatollah Khomeini, they've shut down those protests in Iran, but we had some broadcasts temporarily before they blocked us. And then we saw it move into Tunisia, and then we really saw it culminate in Egypt, which is the one I have on the screen. And the protesters ended up being a peaceful transition of power with President Mubarak, stepping aside. And the number of streams, we were in the hundreds of citizen journalism. I remember watching riot police pushing a crowd back, and about 2.3 million people tuned in to watch these. Pretty remarkable. It's a very interesting experience from a video standpoint when you're watching a riot happen and you know that this is live and you know that these people are, in this case, potentially putting themselves in harm's way for a cause and trying to become a civil society. Incredibly powerful, powered by our mobile broadcast. And this one obviously is still ongoing. And the cool part about what happened is they started forming a community of citizen journalists. They know one another. They have contact with us. We support them to the extent we can. And they broadcast and they communicate. And they were part of what happened with the eventual stepping down of the president. They were part of that process. And this is actually a picture of some Egyptian women one of the squares in London, Trafalgar Square, something like that, I think is what it's called. And they were standing in solidarity for the Egyptian people. What's interesting about this photo, and the reason I put it in here, if you take a look at what's in their hands, virtually every woman in the crowd has a cell phone in her hand. Pretty remarkable, the world that we now live in. And, you know, obviously after Egypt, if you follow any of the current events, the current one that's much more serious is what is happening in Syria. And we have somewhere around 30 to 40 citizen journalists on the ground who are broadcasting and bringing live coverage to the world what's happening on the ground in Syria. To literally where they have mortars falling around them, they're putting their lives in danger, and they're doing it because of their belief in a new government, President Assad. They're trying to get him to step down. It's actually turning very bloody, and they're certainly in harm's way. The interesting part about this is that the groundswell of viewership initially, there was actually a large amount of viewership within Syria, and then the Syrian government started blocking that viewership. So now the citizen journalists are more about getting information out to the rest of the world. It obviously wasn't limited to Syria. Again, if you follow national politics, a few months ago, President Putin, the president of Russia, saw uprising like he's never seen since he's been in power. And there were protests from Russia. It was a guy named Ritus, or at least that's what his screen name was on Ustream. What's remarkable about the protests that we saw in Russia, again, a guy using his cell phone to broadcast live, was that there was 3 million people inside Russia, viewership inside of Russia, that tuned in to watch him watch his broadcast over a two-hour period. Ustream's a fairly large site at this point. That 2 hours did more traffic out of Russia than we did for the entire day amongst all our other countries. It was quite remarkable. And that just demonstrates the power of people being able to witness and see these broadcasts from within their own country. And again, working towards what they disagree with, some of the aspects of the government in Russia. But it was, it's not limited only to the rest of the world. As you may recall, the United States in 2011 had a lot of protests as well, particularly around the Occupy movement. We had over 1,800 citizen journalists who broadcast from the various cities, most of them obviously from New York and the Zuccotti Park. If you remember when the police came in and actually kicked everyone out, we had coverage. We were the only outlet that had coverage because we had citizen journalists inside that park filming what was happening. Police had barred the press from being allowed to be near that as they were kicking out the demonstrators. And we've had close to 4 or 5 million people tune in to watch this across the world. We've had Occupy movements and streams from everything from Oakland. There was a big tear gas of the protesters to L.A., to D.C., you know, and various other cities around the country. And the movement was so interesting that Time said this year was the person of the year was the protester. And the person that you see on the right is a gentleman by the name of Tim Pool. He's a 25-year-old high school dropout. He's from Chicago. He was inspired by what was happening with the Occupy movement. So he got up, left, and armed with a $200 cell phone, went to Zuccotti Park and started streaming from his phone on Ustream. He put the words Ustream on his phone on the outside. He streamed for 21 straight hours, and over 2 million people tuned in to watch his broadcast. It was picked up by CNN, Al Jazeera, BBC, MSNBC, Time, and so on. A 25-year-old dropout was able to get that kind of viewership, and that was all in real time. He ran out of batteries several times in the middle of it and just said, hey, I'm out of batteries. And people who were watching the stream from New York started bringing him batteries. And so he had continuous coverage for 21 straight hours. He was able to raise in one day on Ustream $35,000 to support his cause. And he started traveling around the world and covering more Occupy. In fact, he's en route to the most dangerous place right now, which is probably Syria. And he was also one of the time, he was actually featured in that Time story as one of the protesters of the year. And at Ustream, this groundswell of both bringing information around a crisis and bringing information to people who are their aim is to create a civil society. We don't say the word powered by. We actually talk about internally about being empowered by our technology. For the first time in the history of the world, the networks are strong enough to provide live HD coverage. For the first time in the history of the world, the cameras and the proliferation of these smartphones are on unprecedented levels. And we're seeing this growth. Ustream, one in out of eight broadcasts on Ustream is from a mobile device. And it's growing at a 10% rate month over month. It's pretty remarkable. And the quality continues to get better. I was watching a broadcast the other day, and I literally thought it was from like a satellite truck, and it was just from our app on his cell phone through LTE. It's quite remarkable. And this is the world we live in. Anyone, anywhere can create and share and interact with everyone, everywhere. And we think that trend's only going to continue into the future. It's a pretty powerful image and a very real one. I'll give you two real examples. When Tim Pool was in Zuccotti Park, he was on the verge of being arrested as he was filming and broadcasting live. He ended up not getting arrested when he told the officers he was live on the internet to, at that time, I think it was about 40,000 simultaneous people. They immediately covered their names on their badges and they walked off. Again, I'm not saying he shouldn't or shouldn't have been arrested. I'm just telling you what happened. Another example, we've spoken with some of our citizen journalists and users that are in Syria. And they've told us of instances where police have scattered when they told them they were live on the internet, and they've literally, they think at times, have saved their lives. The people in these governments know to avoid CNN, they know to avoid satellite trucks, and pretty soon they're going to know to avoid live Ustream feeds. And the interconnectedness of what is happening. Again, what's interesting is that they're starting to form communities. And in Syria, They formed a group of about 30 or 40 who know each other, that communicate, they work together. It's been very difficult in Syria to get internet connectivity. With the will of the people, they still have found ways. Some of them even have mobile satellite capability to give them internet to get the information out. And the technology continues to evolve. The pack in the upper left is called a LiveView pack. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of it, but it's essentially, I call it a satellite truck in a box. And they've gotten smaller below it that can now fit on your hip, where they're able to provide a live HD broadcast and essentially be mobile anywhere they go. There are others who are starting to put these broadcasts and cameras on weather balloons. I didn't have a weather balloon, so I just used a regular balloon to give you angles of how big the protests are. We saw this in Poland. We actually sent one into space, a live Ustream broadcast into outer space, which was pretty neat with Samsung, a Samsung phone. And they're even starting to put him on some of these choppers, these remote-controlled airplanes, and then fly them around and give you different angles of the protests. That's a very different world than we grew up in, and things are certainly evolving, and it's pretty remarkable. That's actually the end of my presentation. Thank you all. I'd love to take any questions or comments, or we can discuss more since we have an intimate group.
Hi. I was just wondering what Temple was actually talking about for 21 hours. I mean, if he was in Chicago, was he talking about what was happening in Chicago for the Occupy movement, or was he? Did he have a camera on himself, or what was going on there?
He had his own phone. He was from Chicago. He went to New York, so he was on the ground. He was in ground zero of the not the ground zero of the Occupy movement. So he was in the middle of it. He was interviewing people. He was providing a very new angle. He was interviewing the police at oftentimes, and he was providing coverage. I mean, if you recall, mainstream media had been blocked from that area by the police. So the only cameras that were inside that park for a very long period of time were the ones that were being powered by Ustream. And again, same thing, CNN and various other outlets were actually pulling those feeds because they just didn't have people on the ground inside. What was he talking about? Again, he was talking about his opinion on the movement. He was talking with you, a lot of interviews of what people thought about the movement. And again, he's talking to the chat room. You're able to hold the phone and see what everyone is saying. And he's having a two-way dialogue. It's a very interactive sort of an experience. And so people are asking questions, and he's able to facilitate essentially a show, a news show, that's two-way in real time.
Hi, my name is Brian Nunez. I'm from Witness, and I was actually talking to your colleague Ruby a couple weeks ago. We are a human rights organization that works with the video, so we're very interested in all types of live streaming technology. It was an interesting point that you made about how the protester was sort of protected himself with a live stream, and Ruby also mentioned a similar situation from a live streamer in Syria being chased by the police. There's also the flip side, which is that a lot of these streams are sort of tagged as in terms of where they're geolocated. And one of our concerns is that the immediacy of the situation also makes it harder for people to sort of think through what the security issues are for their live streams. Do you have any sort of outreach that you do with the people that are protesting from difficult areas? And also, what happens with the footage that sort of gets collected on your servers? At some point, you would think that, like the situation in Syria or in Egypt, if any of these war crimes come to trial, what happens with that footage?
Great questions. The first question is the technologies to provide privacy around the live broadcasts are evolving. We're working, I can't get into exactly the details, but we work with the State Department because that is a concern of ours. And we are in the process of putting various things in place to ensure that. This has happened very quickly, and we're certainly not Google. We're not even Facebook, so we only have so many resources. But the realities of it are, there are certain things we do today, and there's more coming, because that is a very real concern for us as well. And in terms of what happens to the footage, well, the broadcaster chooses whether they want to record it or not. That's how our platform works. We don't record everything, so you have the choice. And if you choose to record that footage, just like YouTube, you can delete it as well at some point. In terms of anything like war crimes, I mean, we would comply with, you know, any sort of international requirements and obligations as a business that would come of that. And I don't know much about other than if we got a warrant of something, we would comply.
As Christopher Jasinski here, I'm only supposing this, but as any new media channel develops, and governments and the powers that be in different areas around the world become aware of it, you open up to propaganda from those said organizations. So, you know, this is kind of a pie-in-the-sky question, but, and I know that you probably would never exercise editorial control, but is there any thinking about how you would address a situation like that where something is clearly coming from a government entity and is of a nature that it is propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a tougher one. One, most of the people in our company speak only English, so if we don't understand it, it might be a little bit more difficult for us to understand if it even is propaganda. That being said, I think the power of my platform is that we provide information. And, I mean, even in Syria, if President Assad wanted to come on and do a chat with the world, we would stop that. But, you know, we certainly we value what the goal of some of these folks, and again, in terms of trying to build a civil society, we understand that. But we probably would, if it's not against our direct terms of service for like nudity and copyright, things like that, odds are, you know, we're going to take the stance of that. That's information that it's not our position to judge whether it's right or wrong. Work our way up.
Hey, I'd like to know a little bit about what are some of the trends that you're seeing in usage on the platform itself? I know that you said 2.8 hours is the average usage, and obviously with news and breaking news, it's going to be a hot topic, but overall, some of the trends in topics that are popular, and also I'd like to hear a little bit about how that affects your roadmap going forward.
Well, I don't know what the 2.8 hours, I may have misspoke. The average view time on Ustream is about 28 minutes. So across the entire platform, people tend to watch for 28 minutes. Now, some of our larger broadcasts, the average view time may be 45 minutes or in some cases hours. Like in the Japanese disaster, people watched and just left it up all day and were watching this broadcast. We are seeing the citizen journalists, the news angle, we've seen a lot of growth, and we continue to see this, the power of what we've built, and we're going to continue to foster that. We think that's really important and key to our future. We're also seeing, we want to, going back to the dream of what we want to be about, we want to not just be about the consumption of content. I mean, you can go to YouTube and watch a video, but you want to go to YouTube, we want you to have an experience. When Whitney Houston passes away, and you come to Ustream to talk about that, that's a very different thing than just seeing a tweet. We want people to interact and experiences. And so I think in terms of our roadmap moving forward, you're going to continue to see us go that direction. We want to make the experiences richer. We want to make the connections deeper. We want to make it feel, I mean, if we can't make, we can't bring you to a concert, we want to make it feel like as close as we can through the internet, and what that, that power of when people are watching the same thing as you. You know, I'm a big UFC fan, and, you know, I typically sit by myself. My wife hates it. I'm married. I have kids, so I don't, like, go out drinking or anything, go to a bar. I watch it by myself. And that's a shame. Well, it's not a shame, but why can't I have a more collective experience of the internet with my buddies around the country who are in the similar situation? And so we want these very, very immersive experience around some of this content that is, I mean, incredibly riveting, like nothing that is out there. And so the product roadmap was going to continue to foster that even more.
Can you speak a little bit to the chat feature and how popular that is on the platform?
So when we launched the platform, we had a real, back in 07, we had the crappiest chat in the world. It was just really horrible. And we realized about in 2009, we were the first to do this, that we could leverage Twitter and Facebook in a new way. And we created this thing called a social stream. And we were the first to do it, so we got out early out of the gate. But it was interesting because when a broadcast had a certain size, let's say 800 to 1,000 simultaneous viewers, you were virtually guaranteed to start trending on Twitter. And the reason was the viewers would log into the chat with Twitter, and in the background we would tweet on their account what they said. Now, you know, we were maybe a little aggressive back then, but there was so much activity that caused, you know, artists or someone that could get that size of viewership almost guaranteed you were trending on Twitter, which was pretty powerful there for a while. Then Twitter changed their algorithms a little bit. But the chat feature as it is today is still mostly a text chat. You log in with one of the big networks like Twitter or Facebook. Where we want to go is that's going to become more interactive, more robust, and again, more immersive, both through chat and through video.
Hi, I work for a television station in Seattle, a local news station, and so I'm interested in your business model, and maybe if you could talk a little bit about some of the commercial enterprise customers that you have, and maybe any sort of larger TV stations who are doing innovative things with your platform.
The primary revenue stream for Ustream is still advertising, mostly because I want to provide a free product. I mean, there's something democratizing about the technology, and the way you do that is you try to provide it free. And the way you provide it free is you sell ads against it, and that's just kind of the reality as it is today on the internet. But we also have two other significant models to our business. One is called pro broadcasting. It's essentially for broadcasters like you, where you don't want the ads, or you want more control, or you want more features. We launched that back in November of this year, or October of last year, and it's growing 20% month over month. It's pretty remarkable, and that is a package where we provide a more professional service. We're not in the business to try to be Akamai, if you're familiar with those guys, or Limelight. That's not our business model. We don't want to do that, but we do believe that the power of the platform, both in terms of bringing an audience, which we can do, and bringing some more powerful tools for those broadcasters who want it, is a significant business for us, and we'll continue to be moving forward. We also have a team in LA, an office in LA on Sunset and Highland, in a small studio. So we actually have a production business as well, where we go out and we'll produce big events for broadcasters. So if you're a big red carpet, like the Golden Globes or something, we'll actually go and do the production for you. And that's a significant part of our business as well. And in terms of other TV stations, we have TV stations all over the world that use us, everything from their constant feed, the big ones like CBS News does all their breaking news through Ustream, to the smaller guys that might use us when there's tornadoes, like when the tornadoes happen a couple last week, or whenever the horrible tornado outbreak. We had news stations all over that region that were using us to get that information out, the weather side of it. And so we see a variety. I think that's more and more where we think there's an opportunity for us, and it fits really nicely with the vision and the dream of the platform.
–
So how does that work? Do you watch the UFC fights with your buddies around the country using Ustream?
You can, but today the way you're going to do that is through text chat. So you can watch the same thing. It's live, and you interact while you're watching it through text.
So is the fight on Ustream?
The fight's on Ustream.
Oh, and then you would text about it. Because like the medium is a broadcast, right? So you're not like watching each other.
Today you're not, but the fight itself is on Ustream. In this case, it's a pay-per-view. It's other places. It's on TV, but we have the actual fight, and you're able to interact and watch it while you're collectively over the internet and discuss it in real time.
But that would be cool if there were a way to somehow kind of simultaneously be kind of all in the same room, virtual room together.
I agree.
Yeah.
Hi. I just wanted to get your opinion on traditional journalism. If sites like Ustream are facilitating citizen journalism, what do you think is going to be the future of traditional journalism means?
You know, I think they go hand in hand. I think we still want traditional journalism on our platform, big and small. But I think the citizen journalism movement is another tool for mainstream media to provide another angle, another voice. And in some cases, the only voice, like with Tim Pool, he was the only person that had cameras inside the, at least live cameras inside the park. And so I think, I don't think they are mutually exclusive. I think in fact, they support one another. Some of our citizen journalists broadcasts got so big because they got mainstream coverage, and mainstream coverage was able to have a really compelling story because they were talking about citizen broadcasts. To me, it's just another avenue for information to get out, and perhaps another angle, perhaps more local, more niche in some cases. But it's another way for information to get shared across the world, which is the beauty of the, I mean, it's the fundamental beauty of the internet.
Hi, I'm Yasushi from Tokyo, and I'd like to talk about the disaster in Japan, and you said that the big broadcast company feeds their programs through Ustream. But actually, before the broadcast company feed themselves, one junior high school student illegally captured a television program and feed the program through Ustream. But the broadcast company permitted it. That illegal stream could happen. What do you think about it?
And I'm not aware of that exact story. That's very interesting. And konnichiwa, by the way, welcome. Anytime I think you have open platforms, I mean, that's really what you're talking about, is some of the challenges around an open platform, whether that's us or YouTube or Twitter. And to be an open platform, at least from my perspective, being a West Point graduate and just the values of our company, it comes with a certain level of responsibility. And, you know, we take a strong stance against piracy, the protection of copyright. We're not perfect, but we have a lot of tools in place that do that. Everything from, people may not know this, but we do lots of real-time fingerprinting of all the streams that are happening in real time. If we detect that it's maybe copyrighted content material, we take it down automatically. Plus, we have lots of tools and work with over 300 different copyright owners across the world to allow them to actually take their own content down on Ustream. And various other mechanisms and tools to make sure we're doing the right thing. And, you know, YouTube does have a model where you can choose to take it down or share on the revenue. We don't have that today. But we work with a lot of copyright holders to get official feeds, and that's really our goal. Or else we wouldn't be able to work with the UFC. We wouldn't be able to work with MTV and Viacom, which is a deal we just announced. We wouldn't be able to work with the Japanese government around the 311 celebration. We wouldn't be able to work with the White House, who has a channel on Ustream, and President Obama. So there are still challenges around being an open platform that we haven't 100% figured out. But the values of the company is we want to continue to evolve to make sure that we're on the right side of history.
Arigato. Hi. Have you released any material to the UN with respect to Syria?
Have I released any of the? Have we released any of the material to Syria?
Yeah,
I mean to the UN.
To the UN on Syria.
No, but if it's public and we have private, you can't hide and have private broadcasts. So we do have a large inventory that is not available to the public that a broadcaster may choose to make it private. We have not officially, however, we do work with them. I spoke at the UN at the summit a couple weeks ago at Stanford with all the UN ambassadors for the Human Rights Council across the world. It's been two or three days with all of them. And the U.S. ambassador is a lady named Ambassador Donahoe. And we spent a lot of time talking about, and it was us, it was Twitter, Facebook, and Google. And we spent a lot of time talking about how we can, you know, both surface and make these more available, how we can protect privacy, how we can, you know, train people who want to use the technology for civil societies. But in the case specifically of the United Nations, we have not passed any official content. Have they pulled content? I have no idea if they've pulled openly available content.
Okay. And final question, are you planning on opening an office in the Middle East?
I would love to one day. Right now, there's no plans for the Middle East. We just opened the office in Seoul, and we have some other Asian prospects, and we have some other European prospects. Probably first, the challenge with the Middle East is for a company of my size for it to make sense. Is there's still some connectivity growth that needs to happen. And there's probably some monetization growth and some advancement of how you make money in those countries a little bit more before it would probably make sense for us. I'd love to visit, though, one of these days. Yes, no, yes, no.
Yeah. So when you say that you have live streams, I was wondering how live are they? Like how much delay is there between what's happening on the ground and what people are actually viewing on the site?
It depends. It can be as quick as half a second to depending on the bit rate, the size of the resolution and things of that nature, where it is in the world and where our servers are located, where they come into. If they have to travel a far distance, it'll take a little longer. But typically we say it's half a second to 2 seconds within the typical range of bit rates.
Okay. Can people upload video they shoot offline? So in these areas with poor connectivity, if they're trying to stream, do you have any sort of like local buffering it'll upload later? Or can they just do this sort of YouTube thing like they shoot it and upload to Ustream anyway?
With our mobile phones, you can upload later. In a situation where you lose connectivity and it goes down, you can still record and then upload it later to Ustream. But on the actual site itself, we don't. But there are ways around that.
Have you or any of your team tried to work with people trying to circumvent censorship technologies in these countries? Like, do you guys have a plan? Or, for instance, do you block Tor from uploading?
We are knee deep in the process of protecting privacy for those who broadcast, and we want it as available as possible in those areas where we are currently blocked.
Let's see. Can people grab chunks of raw video for stuff that's already up? So let's say they're streaming hours of video. Can you go in and just grab a chunk and be able to? Like, I don't know, report on that or replay it or something.
Yeah, you
like.
You can create what's called a highlight,
okay.
which has a start time and stop time, and then embed that highlight. I don't think today we have the ability to take that particular chunk and have a raw file come to you. You can take the whole raw file and cut it up yourself.
Okay.
But we do have a highlight feature.
And then with regards to the censorship stuff, I completely understand that you guys would take a really strong position on copyright. With regards to copyright stuff, that you guys would take a strong stance on that. Have you done anything to address the other side of it, which is that The DMCA, for instance, in the U.S. is crafted so that it's quite easy for anybody to sort of censor content by just sending fraudulent DMCA takedown notices. Have you guys been able to address anything like that? Do you allow users to follow the full process of counter notice in the DMCA, that sort of thing?
We absolutely allow people to follow the full counter notice process. We don't have a big issue with it. So we may get like one counter notice a month. I mean, it's pretty unusual for us. And I don't know if that's a...
Yeah, it's a user thing. Usually users don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've seen it, and we follow the process.
Okay. Anybody else want to go? Yeah. I probably have some other ones here. Let's see. Actually, you answered a lot of these. Do you have any sort of support for an API for uploading, like a proxy service? So let's say you're at a protest and you're on the front lines and people are filming on the front lines, and hopefully that idea that they're streaming is some sort of badge of protection for them, but some regimes don't care at all. Do you have any way for, like, say, a user that's streaming to stream through, say, a proxy service, maybe a connection locally to someone that's a couple rows back or, you know, elsewhere in the protest, and then have that sort of upload to you? That was an example use case. Do you allow like some sort of API for uploading?
We definitely have. We have a. It's private at this point, but we have partnerships that we do provide that API to. So we do have one on a case by case basis. There are a lot of ways that you can get feeds in through IP. IP cameras and various other ways that I've seen people leverage Bluetooth and different, you know, really unique, similar to what you're discussing. That is definitely beyond my technical expertise.
Okay.
But I've seen some pretty amazing things with regard to that, whether it's through Wi-Fi or through some of the other protocols.
What about private chats for streams between two individuals that are watching the stream? Do you have any sort of ability for it not to be broadcast to everybody else, but for two people to talk about a particular stream together?
We do on our – we have a thing called a chat room, and then we also have this thing called a social stream. On the chat room, it does because it's based on IRC. On the social stream, it does not. But that's a pretty important capability that we're actually in the process of improving.
Anybody else? I think I'm good.
No, oh, thank you. They said I got 5 minutes. You want one more question? One more right here.
Do you have any sort of API for showcasing your content? Like, you know, getting top stories or something like that, or just knowing what's trending or things like that?
We do. We have APIs that will tell you, you know, various by category, by featured broadcast of some sort, or, you know, whether it's live or not live, because we have that element of it as well. We have those APIs. Yes. And by the way, if anybody, I'll hang around if anyone wants a card, business card, or there's some other folks from Ustream here. We'd love to chat with you. Thank you so much for those of you who made it through that long line. I really appreciate it. Thank you.